Hi all, co-host Morgan here with some exciting news. Team Womance, aka Isabeau and I, will be hosting a panel for Romanticy Fest on March 23rd at 11 a.m. at the Otherworld Theater in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. We'll be in conversation with Megan Mackey, author of Silver Blood Scion, Samara Brieger, author of A Long Time Dead, Melanie Michella, author of Rake Rider Series, and Tamara Giray, author of The Fall That Saved Us. We'll have mimosas and time for audience questions. So if you'd like to join for conversations about fantasy, romance, writing, reading, and of course, ourselves, you can get tickets at otherworldtheater.org/romanticy. Theater spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E. Again, get your tickets to join the panel and tons of other great events around Romanticy like Twihard the Musical, book signings, author Q&As, and a dragon brunch at otherworldtheater.org/romanticy. Now on with our regularly scheduled programming. Hello all, welcome back, hopefully, to the Pride and Prejudice Public Access Read-Along with Womance. I'm your odd chapter reader, Morgan.
And I'm your even chapter reader, Isabeau.
And this chapter is odd. It's 47, as the crow flies in my book. And so that means Isabeau read you the last chapter, 46, and is therefore eminently qualified to give us a brief synopsis of the events of chapter 46.
Lizzie received distressing letters from home from Jane, wherein we learn that Lydia has absconded to what at first is thought Scotland, but then turns out is not, with Wickham. She gets these letters, she's all a fluster, and then she opens the door to call in the gardeners to get in the carriage to go home to try to sort the situation, and who would be at the door but none other than one Mr. Darcy, who then sees her in her total collapse, offers what help he can, which is very little, and then he leaves abruptly after saying, so you're not going to come to lunch today with me and my sis at Pemberley?
So I guess this means you can't come to lunch?
I guess this means you won't be attending the luncheon I set for thee. And then he leaves, and then Lizzie's really sad because it turns out that this new flowering of feeling has just been quashed by Lydia's rash action of running away unmarried with Wickham.
Yeah. And it kind of proves out all of the worst things Darcy said about her initially.
Yeah. It does.
With that, let us commence chapter 47. I've been thinking it over again, Elizabeth, said her uncle as they drove from the town. And really, upon serious consideration, I'm much more inclined than I was to judge as your eldest sister does of the matter. It appears to me so very unlikely that any young man should form such a design against a girl who is by no means unprotected or friendless, and who is actually staying in his colonel's family, that I am strongly inclined to hope for the best. Could he expect that her friends would not step forward? Could he expect to be noticed again by the regiment after such an affront to Colonel Forster? His temptation is not adequate to the risk.
I mean, that feels logical, especially the part about Colonel Forster.
Yeah, and I have to say, actually, like, a much more clear synopsis than Jane herself was able to provide of her feelings.
Absolutely.
Do you really think so? Cried Elizabeth, brightening up for a moment. Upon my word, said Mrs. Gardiner, I beg to be of your uncle's opinion. Is really too great a violation of decency, honor, and interest for him to be guilty of it. I cannot think so very ill of Wickham. Can you yourself, Lizzie, so wholly give him up as to believe him capable of it? Not perhaps of neglecting his own interest, but of every other neglect I can believe him capable. If indeed it should be so, but I dare not hope it. Why should they not go on to Scotland if that had been the case? In the first place, replied Mr. Gardiner, there is no absolute proof that they are not gone to Scotland. Oh, but their removing from the chaise and the hackney coach is such a presumption. And besides, no traces of them were to be found on Barnet Road. Well then, supposing them to be in London, they may be aware, though for the purpose of concealment, for no more exceptional purpose, it is not likely that money should be a very abundant on either side, and it might strike them that they could be more economically, though less expeditiously, married in London than in Scotland. But why all this secrecy? Why any fear of detection? Why must their marriage be private? Oh, no, no, this is not likely. His most particular friend, you see by Jane's account, was persuaded of his never intending to marry her. Wickham will never marry a woman without some money. He cannot afford it. And what claims has Lydia? What attractions has she beyond youth, health, and good humor that could make him, for her sake, forgo every chance of benefiting himself by marrying well? As to what restraint the apprehension of disgrace in the corps might throw on a dishonorable elopement with her, I'm not able to judge, for I know nothing of the effects of that such a step might produce. But as to your other objection, I'm afraid it will hardly hold good. Lydia has no brothers to step forward, and he might imagine, from my father's behavior, from his indolence and the little attention he has ever seemed to give to what was going forward in his family, that he would do as little, and think as little about it, as any father could do in such a matter.
Ooh, that's an indictment.
Said to her uncle and aunt as well. But can you think that Lydia is so lost to everything but love of him as to consent to live with him on any other terms than marriage? It does seem, and it is most shocking indeed, replied Elizabeth with tears in her eyes, that a sister's sense of decency and virtue in such a point should admit of doubt. But really, I know not what to say. Perhaps I'm not doing her justice, but she is very young. She has never been taught to think on serious subjects. And for the last half year, nay, for a twelvemonth, she has been given up to nothing but amusement and vanity. She has been allowed to dispose of her time in the most idle and frivolous manner and to adopt any opinions that come in her sway. Since the shire were first quartered in Meryton, nothing but love, flirtation, and officers have been in her head. She has been doing everything in her power by thinking of talking on the subject to give greater, what shall I call it, susceptibility to her feelings, which are naturally lively enough. And we all know that Wickham has every charm of a person and address that can captivate a woman. But you see that Jane, said her aunt, does not think so ill of Wickham as to believe him capable of the attempt. Of who does Jane ever think ill? Mm-hmm. And who is there, whatever might be their former conduct, that she would believe capable of such an attempt till it were proved against them? But Jane knows as well as I do what Wickham really is. We both know that he has been profligate in every sense of the word, that he has neither integrity nor honor, that he is as false and deceitful as he is insinuating. Do you really know all this? Cried Mrs. Gardiner, whose curiosity as to the mode of their intelligence was all alive. I do indeed, replied Elizabeth, coloring. I told you the other day of his infamous behavior to Mr. Darcy, and you yourself, when last at Longbourn, heard in what manner he spoke of the man who had behaved with such forbearance and liberality towards him. And there are other circumstances which I am not at liberty, which is not worthwhile to relate, but his lies about the whole Pemberley family are endless. And from what he said of Miss Darcy, I was thoroughly prepared to see a proud, reserved, disagreeable girl. Yet he knew to the contrary himself. He must know that she was as amiable and unpretending as we have found her. But does Lydia know nothing of this? Can she be ignorant of what you and Jane seem so well to understand? Little soft indictment from yep. Mrs. Gardiner on Lizzie herself.
If you and Jane know this, why doesn't Lydia?
Oh, yes. That is the worst of all. Till I was in Kent and saw so much both of Mr. Darcy and his relation, Colonel Fitzwilliam, I was ignorant of the truth myself, and when I returned home, the shire was to leave Meryton in a week or fortnight's time. As that was the case, neither Jane, to whom I related the whole, nor I thought it necessary to make our knowledge public. For of what use could it apparently be to any of the good opinion which all the neighborhood had of him should then be overthrown?
I don't know, like this exact scenario.
Right. And it wouldn't have to be your own sister. It could be like any local girl or like any of their local girls' cousins who would run into him.
He almost married one of them already.
Exactly. Come on.
Get your head out of your ass, Lizzie.
I know. She's like, it wouldn't have done any good. I'm like, there are other women.
What would the point have been? You're living out the point.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it was settled that Lydia should go with Mrs. Forrester, the necessity of opening her eyes to his character never occurred to me. That she could be in any danger from the deception never entered my head. That such a consequence as this would ensue, you may easily believe, was far enough from my thoughts. That's shitty, Lizzie. I never thought he'd go for my sister. I mean, she's like,
She's vapid and shallow, and I don't like her that much.
Yeah, and I'm not those things, and he went for me.
So how could he like Lydia?
Yeah, this is all a little prideful.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why the title. Do you think that could be it?
Guess we'll have to keep reading.
When they all removed to Brighton, therefore, you had no reason, I suppose, to believe them fond of each other. Not the slightest. I can remember no symptom of affection on either side, and had anything of the kind been perceptible, you must be aware that ours is not a family on which it could be thrown away. When first he entered the corps, she was ready enough to admire him, but so we all were. Every girl in or near Meryton was out of her senses about him for the first 2 months. But he never distinguished her by any particular attention, and consequently, after a moderate period of extravagant and wild admiration, her fancy for him gave way, and the others of the regiment, who treated her with more distinction, again became her favorites. It may be easily believed that however little of novelty could be added to their fears, hopes, and conjectures on this interesting subject by its repeated discussion, no other could detain them from it long during the whole of the journey. From Elizabeth's thoughts, it was never absent. Fixed there by the keenest of all anguish, self-reproach, she could find no interval of ease or forgetfulness.
Is that the keenest of the anguishes? Of all anguish, self-reproach?
What would you say? How would you? Okay.
I think it's up there. Top three. Absolutely.
Okay. What is your top three ranking of keenest of all anguishes? Self-reproach is in there, but it's not number one.
Yeah. I think like death of a loved one would be a big anguish.
But where does that anguish come from? Regret?
Not being able to talk to them anymore. I did think regret, right? Like for something that you don't do, but that is shades of self-reproach. So maybe self-reproach is number two because it has so many other like interlocutors.
Yeah.
But I think death of a loved one.
But I would say like whenever you grieve the death of a loved one, I mean, there's so much freighted in that that almost feels like we got to pick it apart. Is it fear of one's own mortality?
Mm.
Is that numero uno anguish?
I don't know. It's such a big claim that I'm like.
Loneliness.
Loneliness feels like a big anguish. Yeah.
Sorry, Austin. Agree to disagree.
It's like, I need more for this claim to stand.
They traveled as expeditiously as possible, and sleeping one night on the road, reached Longbourn by dinner time the next day. It was a comfort to Elizabeth to consider that Jane could not have been wearied by long expectations. The little gardeners, attracted by the sight of a chaise, were standing on the steps of the house as they entered the paddock, and when the carriage drove up to the door, the joyful surprise that lighted up their faces and displayed itself over their whole bodies in a variety of capers and frisks was the first pleasing earnest of their welcome. Elizabeth jumped out, and after giving each of them a hasty kiss, an hasty kiss is how it's written in my book.
An hasty
kiss. Hurried into the vestibule, where Jane, who came running downstairs from her mother's apartment, immediately met her. Elizabeth, as she affectionately embraced her, whilst tears filled the eyes of both, lost not a moment in asking whether anything had been heard of the fugitives. "Not yet," replied Jane, "but now my dear uncle is come, I hope everything will be well." "Is my father in town?" "Yes, he went on Tuesday as I wrote you word." "And have you heard from him often?" "We have heard only once. He wrote me a few lines on Wednesday to say he had arrived in safety and to give me his directions, which I particularly begged him to do. He merely added that he should not write again till he has something of importance to mention. My mother, how is she? How are you all? My mother is tolerably well, I trust, though her spirits are greatly shaken. She is upstairs and will have great satisfaction in seeing you all. She does not yet have her leave her dressing room. Mary and Kitty, thank heaven, are quite well. But you, how are you? Cried Elizabeth. You look pale. How much you must have gone through. Her sister, however, assured her of her being perfectly well, and their conversation, which had been passing while Mr. and Mrs. Gardner were engaged with their children, was now put at an end by the approach of the whole party. Jane ran to her uncle and aunt and welcomed and thanked them both with alternate smiles and tears. I want to hold here for a moment and talk about the fact that one time when I was talking to my brother, who shares both parents with me, one time I referred to our mom as my mom, and he was relentless in mocking me for it. But Jane and Lizzie get to do it.
Like, on both their parents in smooth conversation, as if they don't share both of these human beings.
My mom is upstairs crying. I don't know where your mom is right now.
And my father, is he in London?
My father is in London. It is weird.
But like, it must be a thing of the time where you give the personal honorific, like, there's no other reason to write it.
Yeah. I'm just an old-fashioned gal, and Adam never appreciated that about me.
It's true.
But also, it's dumb and embarrassing, and what if I had done it in public?
Oh, my God. It's also funny when I catch myself saying it to my much older sibling as well. And I'm like, my mom, she's like, our mom.
Our mother.
And like, yes, correct. Obviously. Whoops. Thank you.
Okay, but it's my story, so.
Right? Like, you weren't even there.
Yeah. When you're not present, she's just my mom.
The thing that happened was happening to me with my mother. Our mother, our shared human mother, is different.
And then our mom. Stop. They're both weird. It's impossible. Just stop talking about your parents with your siblings.
Well, pigs will fly before that happens.
Just give it up, everybody. Cut it out.
It's the only reason to have siblings, so you can talk about mom and dad behind their back.
Yesterday, we got a donut, and I cut the donut in half, and I started eating my half. And I had like a little quarter of my half left, but there was a whole C, you know, like a intact donut half. And Brandon walks in the room and he just, my little quarter that was remaining. Thank you. Yeah. And I was like, why would you do that?
Why would you do that?
Why would you do that? There was a whole half and he was like, I don't see what the big deal is. And I was like, you know, sometimes I think like maybe it's better to just have one child. And then you do something like that. And I want to write everyone I know who only has one baby and be like, you need another one. ASAP.
It's this blithe understanding that like the world and all of its pieces just is like for you and unavailable without thinking of like why someone would have just a perfect little bite-sized piece wait when there's also a full C waiting.
It's that's like yours. This is mine.
Right. It's clear to me that
worked up. I slapped my microphone.
It's like Brandon never had to share the back seat with someone who would like hold their hand this close to your face and say, I'm not touching you.
Yeah. Boundaries. And yeah, I get it. I could just get a little piece off of his half. I get that. And we would still be square.
That's not the point.
That's not the point.
I understand that that's not the point. That's not your half.
Yes.
I get it.
There are boundaries.
I wouldn't have done that to you.
I know.
I have so many siblings.
You would have observed the situation.
Yeah, I would have read that story.
Anyways, I should have divorced him on the spot.
You could wait. You see if it happens again.
irreconcilable differences. Emotional torment. Check. Check. When they were all in the drawing room, the questions which Elizabeth had already asked were, of course, repeated by the others, and they soon found that Jane had no intelligence to give. The sanguine hope of good, however, which was the benevolence of her heart suggested, had not yet deserted her. She still expected that it would all end well, and that every morning would bring some letter, either from Lydia or her father, to explain their proceedings, and perhaps announce their marriage. Mrs. Bennet, to whose apartment they all repaired after a few minutes' conversation together, received them exactly as might be expected, with tears and lamentations of regret, invectives against the villainous conduct of Wickham, and the complaints of her own sufferings and ill usage, blaming everybody but the person to whose ill-judging indulgence the errors of her daughter must be principally owing. If I had been able, said she, to carry my point of going to Brighton with all my family, this would not have happened. But poor dear Lydia had nobody to take care of her. Why did the Forsters ever let her go out of their sight? I am sure there was some great neglect or other on their side, for she is not the kind of girl to do just such a thing. If she had been well looked after, I always thought that they were very unfit to have the charge of her, but I was overruled, as I always am. Poor dear child, and now here's Mr. Bennet gone away, and I know he will fight Wickham wherever he meets him, and then he will be killed, and what is to become of us all? The Collinses will turn us out before he is cold in his grave, and if you are not kind to us, brother, I do not know what we shall do.
Some real catastrophizing, but all those are real stakes.
It's all real.
It's all real.
They all exclaimed against such terrific ideas, and Mr. Gardiner, after general assurances of his affection for her and all her family, told her that he meant to be in London the very next day and would assist Mr. Bennet in every endeavor for the recovering of Lydia, including murder.
He'll be the second. He'll let Mr. Bennet get murdered.
Do not give way to useless alarm, added he. Though it is right to be prepared for the worst, there is no occasion to look on it as certain. It is not quite a week since they left Brighton. In a few days more, we may gain some news of them. Until we know that they are not married and have no designs of marrying, do not let us give the matter over as lost. As soon as I get to town, I shall go to my brother and make him come home with me to Gracechurch Street. And then we may consult together as to what is to be done. Oh, my dear brother, replied Mrs. Bennet, that is exactly what I could most wish for. And now do, when you get to town, find them out, whatever they may be. And if they are not married already, make them marry. And as for wedding clothes, do not let them wait for that, but tell Lydia she shall have as much money as she chooses to buy them after they are married. And above all things, keep Mr. Bennet from fighting. Tell him what a dreadful state I am in, that I am frightened out of my wits and have such tremblings, such flutterings all over me, such spasms in my side and pains in my head and such beatings in my heart, that I can get no rest by night nor by day, and tell my dear Lydia not to give any directions about her clothes until she has seen me, for she does not know which are the best warehouses. Oh, brother, how kind you are. I know you will contrive it all.
He is a good big brother.
Yes. But Mr. Gardiner, though he assured her again of his earnest endeavors in the cause, could not avoid recommending moderation to her, as well in her hopes as her fears. And after talking with her in this manner till dinner was on the table, they left her to vent all her feelings on the housekeeper, who attended in the absence of her daughters. Though her brother and sister were persuaded that there was no real occasion for such seclusion from the family, they did not attempt to oppose it, for they knew that she had not prudence enough to hold her tongue before the servants while they waited at the table, and judged it better that one only of the household, and the one whom they could trust most, should comprehend all her fears and solicitude on the subject. In the dining room, they were soon joined by Mary and Kitty, who had been too busily engaged in their separate apartments to make their appearance before. One came from her books and the other from her toilette. The faces of both, however, were tolerably calm, and no change was visible in either, except for the loss of her favorite sister or the anger which she had herself incurred in the business had given something more of fretfulness than usual to the accents of Kitty. As for Mary, she was mistress enough of herself to whisper to Elizabeth with a countenance of grave reflection soon after they were seated at table. "This is a most unfortunate affair and will probably be much talked of, but we must stem the tide of malice and pour into the wounded bosoms of each other the balm of sisterly consolation."
"Thanks, Mary."
Then, perceiving in Elizabeth no inclination of replying, she added, "Unhappy as the event must be for Lydia, we may draw from it this useful lesson, that loss of virtue in a female is irretrievable, that one false step involves in her an endless ruin, that her reputation is no less brittle than it is beautiful, and that she cannot be too much guarded in her behavior towards the underserving of the other sex." Elizabeth lifted up her eyes in amazement, but was too much oppressed to make any reply. Mary, however, continued to console herself with such kind of moral extractions from the evil before them. In the afternoon, the two elder Miss Bennets were able to be for half an hour by themselves, and Elizabeth instantly availed herself of the opportunity of making many inquiries, which Jane was equally eager to satisfy. After joining in general lamentations over the dreadful sequel of this event, which Elizabeth considered all but certain, and Miss Bennet could not assert to be wholly impossible, the former continued the subject by saying, "But tell me all and everything about it which I have not already heard. Give me farther particulars. What did Colonel Forster say? Had they no apprehension of anything before the elopement took place? They must have seen them together forever." Colonel Forster did own that he had often suspected some partiality, especially on Lydia's side, but nothing to give him any alarm. I am so grieved for him. His behavior was attentive and kind to the utmost. He was coming to us in order to assure us of his concern before he had any idea of their not being gone to Scotland. When that apprehension first got abroad, it hastened his journey. "And was Denny convinced that Wickham could not marry? Did he know of their intending to go off? Had Colonel Forster seen Denny himself?" "Yes, but when questioned by him, Denny denied knowing anything of their plan and would not give his real opinion about it. He did not repeat his persuasion of their not being marrying, and from that, I am inclined to hope he might have been misunderstood before." "Until Colonel Forster came himself, not one of you entertained a doubt, I suppose, of their really being married? How was it possible that such an idea should enter our brains? I felt a little uneasy, a little fearful of my sister's happiness with him in marriage, because I knew that his conduct had not always been quite right. My father and mother knew nothing of that. They only felt how imprudent a match it must be. Kitty then owned, with a very natural triumph on knowing more than the rest of us, that in Lydia's last letter she had prepared her for such a step. She had known, it seems, of their being in love with each other many weeks. But not before they went to Brighton. No, I believe not. And did Colonel Forster appear to think ill of Wickham himself? Does he know his real character?" "I must confess that he did not speak so well of Wickham as he formerly did. He believed him to be imprudent and extravagant, and since this sad affair had taken place, it is said that he left Meryton greatly in debt. But I hope this may be false."
Jesus, Jane.
"Oh, Jane, had we been less secret, had we told what we knew of him, this could not have happened." "Perhaps it would have been better," replied her sister, "but to expose the former faults of any person without knowing what their present feelings were seemed unjustifiable. We acted with the best intentions."
Cold comfort.
"Could Colonel Forster repeat the particulars of Lydia's note to his wife? He brought it with him for us to see." Jane then took it from her pocketbook and gave it to Elizabeth. These were the contents. "My dear Harriet, you will laugh when you know where I am gone, and I cannot help laughing myself at your surprise tomorrow morning as soon as I am missed. I am going to Gretna Green, and if you cannot guess with who, I shall think you a simpleton, for there is but one man in the world I love, and he is an angel. I should never be happy without him, so think it no harm to be off. You need not send them word at Longbourn of my going. If you do not like it, for it will make the surprise the greater when I write to them and sign my name, Lydia Wickham. What a good joke it will be! I can hardly write for laughing. Pray my excuses to Pratt for not keeping my engagement and dancing with him tonight. Tell him I hope he will excuse me when he knows all, and tell him I will dance with him at the next ball we meet with great pleasure. I shall send for my clothes when I get to Longbourn, but I wish you would tell Sally to mend a great slit in my worked muslin gown before they are packed up. Goodbye. Give my love to Colonel Forster. I hope you will drink to our good journey. Your affectionate friend, Lydia Bennett. Oh, thoughtless, thoughtless Lydia, cried Elizabeth when she had finished it. What a letter is this to be written at such a moment, but at least it shows that she was serious in this object of her journey. Whatever he might afterwards persuade her to, it was not on her side of a scheme of infamy. My poor father, how he must have felt it. I never saw anyone so shocked. He could not speak a word for 10 full minutes. My mother was taken ill immediately, and the whole house in such confusion. Oh, Jane, cried Elizabeth, was there a servant belonging to it who did not know the whole story before the end of the day? I do not know. I hope there was. But to be guarded at such a time is very difficult. My mother was in hysterics, and though I endeavored to give her every assistance in my power, I'm afraid I did not do so much as I might have done. But the horror of what possibly happened almost took from me my faculties. Your attendance upon her has been too much for you. You do not look well. Oh, that I had been with you. You have had every care and anxiety upon yourself alone. Mary and Kitty have been very kind, and would have shared in every fatigue, I'm sure, but I did not think it right for either of them. Kitty is slight and delicate, and Mary studies so much that her hours of repose should not be broken in on. My Aunt Phillips came to Longbourn on Tuesday after my father went away, and was so good as to stay till Thursday with me. She was of great use and comfort to us all. And Lady Lucas has been very kind. She walked here on Wednesday morning to condole with us, and offered her services, or any of her daughters, if they could be of use to us. She had better have stayed at home, cried Elizabeth. Perhaps she meant well, but under such misfortune as this, one cannot see too little of one's neighbors. Assistance is impossible, condolence insufferable. Let them triumph over us at a distance and be satisfied. She then proceeded to inquire into the measures which her father had intended to pursue while in town for the recovery of his daughter. So many singular possessive pronouns. He meant, I believe, replied Jane, to go to Epsom, the place where they last changed horses, see the postillions, and try if anything could be made out from them. His principal object must be to discover the number of the hackney coach which took them to Clapham. It had come with a fare from London, and he thought the circumstance of a gentleman and ladies removing from one carriage into another might be remarked. He meant to make inquiries at Clapham. If he could anyhow discover at what house the coachman had before set down his fare, he determined to make inquiries there and hoped it might not be impossible to find out the stand and number of the coach. I do not know of any other designs that he had formed, but he was in such a hurry to be gone and his spirits so greatly discomposed that I had difficulty in finding out even so much as this. And that is the abrupt ending of chapter 47.
What do you think?
I mean, Jane's villainy is on full ticker tape parade in this. Villainy might be a strong word, but she's certainly problematic. I mean, she just, like, refuses to see, I don't know, accountability. Not accountability. She refuses to see, accountability for anyone on anything, including herself.
She is self-deluded to the point of harm. Like, if you can't see things clearly about yourself or your sisters or your own actions to even regret them, like, oh, if only we'd been more honest with our sisters. And she's like, we had the best intentions. I'm like, intention isn't the same as outcome. buckaroo.
Yeah, and it's also like, did you have the best intentions? It seems like you just had like more self-preserving intentions.
Yeah.
Like, you can say it was for Wickham's sake all you want, but it's mostly that you just wanted to keep it a little secret.
That you didn't want to get into conflict with the town, which was like, Wickham's great. But if they'd started spreading that around, they would have found out much sooner that Wickham also had debts all around town. And she's like, I hope that's not true. And I'm like, okay, let's follow that to its logical conclusion. If you hope that the rumor that he has a bunch of debts isn't true in Meryton, that means that you want all the shopkeepers to be liars. Those are your friends and neighbors, Jane. And that's the thing with, like Jane's insistence on everyone's goodness, like, cannot hold, right? We don't live in a world of binaries, certainly, but sometimes there are some binary choices. Like, if Wickham did the thing, that exonerates the shopkeepers. If he didn't do it, that means all of your neighbors are fucking liars and thieves.
Yeah. And it's also, like, I don't even think she thinks of it that much. I think she always just says the nice thing, or what she thinks is the nice thing. And I don't think she ever considers the implications. Like, she's not actually being this wonderfully effusive, egalitarian, mm-mm, moral person. She's just being, like, missed.
I think Jane's, like, and you can only exist that way if you live entirely in the present, right? Like, pulling
Wow,
in-
that's really true.
Right? Like, she's not pulling in anybody's past. She's, like, willing to forgive it immediately. She doesn't use any of her own, like, historical actions to, like, judge someone by, even when she's like, well, I experienced this thing, but maybe it wasn't right. Like, it's bananas. Like, missed, as you say, right? Like, she exonerates herself. She exonerates her parents. She exonerates Lydia. She, like, no one's held responsible for anything. Everyone is literally just in the moment that they're in. And she is, like, they're trying to, I don't know what's going on with them. They're trying to live their best life. And it's like, no, you have direct proof that they're not.
I think it's also living in the moment utterly, but it also belies this, like, detest, maybe not detest, but like just a real disregard for context, which I think is something we saw Lizzie doing for most of the novel until she was confronted by Darcy in the world's meanest proposal.
Yeah.
And then she was like, oh shit, other people know this stuff? And it's like, of course they do. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone can see what's going on here.
I think what's so good about the meanest proposal in the world is that, like, that thing that you just said about context is, like, Lizzie wasn't dumb to her context and she wasn't unembarrassed by her family. But because of the context of Meryton and their neighbors and, like, this sort of begrudging or even, like, indulgence around, yeah, everyone knowing them, she didn't have to confront the context in the same way as, like, an outsider giving her a much more objective view was, like, cold water. And it was mean. He could have said it much nicer, but, like, all of those things were also true.
It's just deeply provincial. Like, what would be, like, internally provincial, like, on an, mm-hmm, individual level. Anyways, I wonder if anyone could exist like this in the smartphone era.
Just entirely in the present?
Just like utter. Yeah, I realize it's a dumb question now. Like, it seems like, of course, they could exist without context. Of course, like, because you just get fed a lot of reassurances via your social feeds anyways, now that they use the algorithm.
Look at this sourdough.
Yeah. And I, you're just like, make everything sourdough.
Everything's sourdough. It's like the thing about the, I don't want to get into it, like, because, like, I don't have fully formed thoughts about the algorithm and tradwives and, like, this whole thing. But it seems to me that this sort of unquestioning present moment of, like, I'm not anti-feminist. I'm a trad wife. It's just more comfortable. I like my slow mornings and I like making Greek yogurt from scratch. And I'm like, okay, that's like, it's cool that you can live in a bubble that is without context, I guess, for you. But, like, it's also selfish, where it's like, if you're refusing everyone else's context or a societal context or even, like, a community context.
Also, like, It is that, like, highly, like, individualized provinciality because they are working. Like, they're making money off of social media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, also, like, people who work 40 hours a week can make their own Greek yogurt. Y'all, it's not that hard to do.
It's
the main
not.
Ingredient is time, and it's not even, like, the oven can be off, essentially.
Yeah, it's a big pot and some milk.
Everyone should make their own yogurt.
I was just thinking of that the other day. My mom used to make our yogurt.
I need to make some yogurt.
Yep.
And with that,
loosen your prides.
But never your prejudice.
Maybe some of them, but not about Wickham.
Mwah.